Hello, listeners. This is David Blakesley welcoming you to episode 68 of the Criterion Reflections podcast, in which a couple guests and I will be discussing Mike Hodges' film of 1971 titled Get Carter. We are back in the Criterion Channel zone here. Our most recent episode was three of the science fiction films in that January-only bundle that will be expiring in just a few days. We talked about A Clockwork Orange, THX 1138, and The Omega Man. And one of those guests who helped me sort through those films is back with me today, David Seeley. Welcome back to the podcast.
Hello. Hello, everyone. And thanks for having me, David.
Yeah, you've been a pretty regular here, and so has this next guy, Richard Doyle. Richard, welcome back.
Thanks. Hello, everyone.
Yeah, David and Richard, you have been a couple of my studies in recent months here, and I really appreciate you getting it together to talk about this film with me. So there's a bundle on the Criterion Channel, Three by Michael Caine, or Three with Michael Caine, or Caine and Three, or whatever it is. But the three films by Michael Caine, The Italian Job, and Get Carter, and what's the other one? Alfie, maybe?
Yeah, it's Alfie.
Yeah, Alfie. So we're talking about the one that comes out in 1971. I'm not sure I'm going to cover the other two. Alfie was a previous year's release, and I'm not sure we're going to cover The Italian Job, which came out after this one. But we will talk about Get Carter. I kind of threw a little question out on my Facebook group where I says, is Get Carter worth fitting into the queue? Because technically speaking, we are past the chronological point. This was a February of 1971 release. I've already made my way through the releases of June or July. But I got a few recommendations saying, yeah, this is an important film. This is definitely one worth talking about. And so I sort of threw it in the queue, kind of on short notice. And so here we are. We're going to talk about this return of the gangster film, as it was kind of marketed, and not only just the gangster film, but an English gangster film. And so I've got a couple guys from the broader sense of the United Kingdom, Richard in Canada, David over in the UK, although you've got Canadian roots. And we're going to venture on up to Newcastle to talk about the gritty, grimy milieu in which Jack Carter takes his revenge. If you'll excuse my accent, somebody killed me, baby brother, and I'm fitting to figure out who did it. And so, yeah. And
that's the best Geordie accent I've ever heard.
Thank you, Dave. I will take that as a high compliment indeed. So, yeah, we are here, a little revenge drama, a little gangster showdown, and this is a film that, you know, I watched it first. I said, okay, it didn't exactly match the vibe. I watched it last weekend. I was in this kind of mellow, cozy, you know, comfy at home, state of mind. And I said, well, duty calls. I got to watch Get Carter. And so I am plunged into the midst of this pretty nasty, vicious criminal underworld in the north of England.
It's not exactly a Christmas movie, is it?
It's about family, though.
Yeah.
It is about those proverbial family ties. So, let's kind of hear from a couple of you guys. What are your responses? Richard, I'll give you the first take at it. What interested you in guesting on this particular episode?
I'm very, very fond of this film. I think it's sort of important not only from when it came out and that it sort of redefined this genre, the British gangster film, but it's got a lot of, you know, it's got future influence, including films that are in the Criterion collection like Mona Lisa and Long Good Friday.
Yeah, I really do see, and I'm very thankful that we've watched this film, because I do feel it's very foundational to those two films in particular that you've just mentioned, and just a whole lot more, you know, that's come out ever since. Yeah, and you know, I don't really know much about the history of English gangster films. I've watched a lot of British films in my podcasting and blogging journey over the last decade plus, but there hasn't really been a lot that's been specifically crime-focused. I mean, there's certainly been a lot of, you know, French gangster films, Japanese Yakuza films, American crime classics, all of that. Film noir, of course, is replete with, you know, lives and films focused on the criminal life. I just did an episode with Josh Hornbeck about police stories on his very nice Criterion Channel Surfing podcast. So we kind of delved into a few examples of that genre that are currently streaming on the Criterion Channel. But this did feel like this kind of a new novel twist and flavor here. And so I appreciated that. And I do feel it sets us up for some of the films that we'll be talking about somewhere down the road. David, what's your response to this film?
Well, one of the reasons I kind of put myself forward to speak to you tonight about it is because it's one of those films that, living in the UK all these years, it's quite a sort of standard feature on television, and it's quite a popular film, and I've seen it probably a couple times over the years. And although I like it, I enjoyed it, I never really looked at it sort of seriously or critically before. So I thought it would be interesting to do that, because in the context of your podcast, we obviously dig a little deeper and sort of analyze it a little bit. And it's been quite a rewarding few days. I've kind of immersed myself in Get Carter, and I've really enjoyed it, actually. And the film has risen in my esteem quite a bit, I think, over the last few days.
Well, let me take a minute. I'm going to read a very brief review. It's a couple paragraphs long, and this is a review that was written in 1971 when this film first came out. It's from an anthology that I've quoted at other times on this podcast called Film 71-72, and they did a different volume each year for several years in the late 60s, early 70s. This is by members of the National Society of Film Critics. And the review of Get Carter was written by Arthur Knight. And he says, Mike Hodges, the writer and director of Get Carter, comes from television. I suspect that the television syndrome is basically at fault here. In television series such as It Takes a Thief and Mod Squad, the central characters are catapulted into a situation in the first or pilot episode, but their motivation for continuing their activities are never examined again. They go through their routines, getting beaten up, shooting almost at random, making hairbreadth escapes in fast cars, and emerge victorious at the end of the program so that they can do it all over again the following week. The emphasis is on the action, not the people, and all sorts of weird coincidences enter into the scripting to make it possible for the stars to survive for at least one more episode. Get Carter, starting Michael Caine as Carter, departs from this formula only insofar as Carter does not survive. He is neatly plugged between the eyes at the film's end.
Spoiler alert!
Yeah, thanks, reviewer. But we'll talk about spoilers and other senses, I'm sure, in just a minute. But in all other respects, this is television on the big screen. More sex, more violence, but no more attention to motivation or plot logic. At the outset, against the advice of his gang, Carter travels to Newcastle to avenge his brother's death. Hard guys block his path. In Newcastle, we turn to Carter's niece, who has appeared in pornographic films, just possibly is really his daughter. Is Carter out to avenge his brother's death or to punish the men who abused his daughter? Carter doesn't seem to care. As in television action shows, he kills indiscriminately, and the film positively revels in the killings. Caine, sounding startlingly like the Jimmy Cagney of the old Warner gangster movies, stalks through the picture with literally no change in expression. Playwright John Osborne is more effective as Carter's loyal opposition, but then villainous roles are always the more interesting ones of this in this sort of thing. Get Carter leaves one wanting more, or less. Mm-hmm. So let's dedicate the rest of this episode to proving Arthur Knight wrong.
That sounds very much like a review where he kind of made up his mind a little bit going in, doesn't it?
Oh, yeah. Very dismissive. Yeah.
I think he's pretty desperately wrong about one thing, in that while it's true that it's a fairly violent film, the violence is more downplayed than he thinks it is.
Right. I actually feel like it could be exploited even further. It's so kind of cold-hearted and just so efficient that it's like, wow, you don't really get the sense of the violence that's taken place until you sort of look back on it and think, wow, that was pretty brutal.
Yeah,
it's all very matter of fact and sometimes happens very quickly and so just remorselessly that it does have a lot more impact, even though if you examine the film, it isn't, but certainly by today's standards, I wouldn't say it's particularly violent, and there isn't a lot of violent acts through the picture, but they're all quite powerful when they do happen.
One of the things I think's sort of important about this film is that it's kind of got at least two major creative sources on it. And one of them is Michael Caine himself, right? Who very much wanted to be in this film and said that one of the reasons he wanted to be in this film was because he had known people like Carter and he didn't think they were ever portrayed accurately on film. And that one of the things that he wanted to really stress in it was that violence is not flamboyant. It's very quick and efficient, and that's one of the reasons the film is the way it is.
So you're saying that Michael Caine really sought this role out. Tell us a little bit more about that as far as your understanding. I do agree that the basicness of this, the kind of ruthlessness, is a very compelling aspect of this film. It makes it feel convincing and raw and unsettling because of that. It's not a ballet of violence. It's not this choreographed, you know, escapade where we're actually kind of used to that kind of thing. This is, you know, pretty teeth clenching, gut wrenching stuff.
Caine is really like a rising star at this time. So this was kind of an odd film for him to take. And he said that he wanted to take this because he grew up in an area where he knew men like Carter.
Mm-hmm.
And he thought they were always portrayed on film as either comical or dumb.
Mm-hmm.
And he thought these men, he knew them, and they're neither of those. They're, as he's playing them in this film, a very ruthless, efficient people, sort of doing a job and not being violent for the sake of being violent, but being violent to do something. And that's one of the things I really like about this film. It's very centered on he's made a decision that he's going to do X, and nothing is going to stand in his way of doing X.
Yeah, it's like he doesn't have a lot of alternatives. You know, he's so deep into this life and so notorious for what he does and how he does it that, you know, the whole idea of going straight, you know, getting legitimate as his former accomplice Eric tries to play off in their little encounter at the racetrack. You know, he's got a uniform on, he's a chauffeur, he's, you know, earning a wage and getting a pension. Well, you know, Jack Carter sees right through that, you know, come off it, Eric. And once you're in, you'll never get out. It's basically a one-way ticket, and you'll just ride this out as long as circumstances allow you to live. And so Michael Caine, and I don't know a lot of his personal backstory, you know, but he's definitely a very fascinating character, and the blend of machismo, but intelligence and a certain degree of elegance. I mean, he certainly can play, you know, upper crust, higher society characters, and he did over the course of his career. He's trim. He's no nonsense. He's calculated. You know, even taking issue with the review. I mean, he's pretty serious throughout the film, but there are times when a little humor comes through. In fact, you know, that's one of the recurring lines. Still got your sense of humor. You know, it's a grim humor, but it's very idiomatic of just the kind of life that this guy has lived. You know, he's done horrible, violent things to people. He's seen people he cares about terribly mistreated, and he's gone through his own share of rough stuff himself. That's his view of life and of the world and the reality that he inhabits. And no soft soap or happy talk is going to convince him otherwise.
I think there's an element of resentment in him as well. If I kind of interpret the film a little bit, if I may, as a here's someone, he's gone down to London, he's made it kind of big in his chosen profession, or he's kind of clawed up to a position where he's obviously got lots of money and he's doing well, and he kind of almost resents having to go back home to his hometown and see all these people that he's kind of left behind. And he even says at one point to the girl on the bridge, you know, the only reason I came back to this, you know, crap house, I think is the word he says, is because I wanted to sort this out with my brother. So there's a real resentment there about I even had to come back to this place. And it's probably quite worth talking a little bit about Newcastle. Well, maybe we could come back to that in a minute.
Well, if you want to go into Newcastle, I'm very interested. I mean, obviously you're there in the UK and Newcastle. I just know there's this Newcastle brown ale that I've had on a few occasions, probably their most famous export. But you certainly get a sense of the place. The street locations, a lot of non-professional actors, local characters. I think Mike Hodges, that was part of his objective as well as Michael Caine's, was to show, you know, real life in this, you know, pretty sensational story. So, yeah, go ahead and tell us about Newcastle.
Well, Newcastle, I mean, I obviously, as being a sort of an expat Canadian, I don't claim to be any kind of expert in about Newcastle. But I guess I've just read up a little bit about the context of Newcastle in sort of the late 60s, early 70s. Was a city that was very much in the grips of a lot of poverty at the time. A lot of the sort of traditional industries for the city, the coal mining, had kind of disappeared over the years, and it was quite a center of shipbuilding for many decades, certainly from the war onwards. And at this point in time, there was a real decline, I guess, in the local economy. So there was a great deal of poverty and hardship that was going on in the area at the time. And so the context for the characters is that obviously people want to get out of that situation and would be willing to go to any kind of desperate acts. I mean, those are obviously the circumstances where crime can flourish, because people are trying to claw ahead and get ahead and drag themselves out of the kind of situations that they're in. So it's a situation where organized crime was really beginning to assert itself in the 60s. Obviously, everyone will be familiar with the Cray brothers, which have become quite legendary figures, but you could even trace their involvement to the kind of Get Carter story. The original book that the film was based on, Jack's Return Home, was itself kind of loosely based on a very famous murder up in the area at the time called the One-Armed Bandit Murders. And this was a case where that they think that the Cray brothers might have been involved in that, as they were trying to kind of move the boundaries of their crime syndicate further up north. And they there was a quite a high-profile murder of someone who used to the reason they called them one-armed bandits was because they were the kind of slot machines that they used to put in the pubs and the working man clubs. And there was a lot of organized crime was tied to the supply of this equipment. And there was a very high-profile murder. And that the author of the book kind of based a lot of his writings on that. And I think Newcastle really is almost like a character in the film, isn't it? Because the all the locations are very authentic. They shot the film very much in sort of the available light in genuine locations. Like the parking garage is got a interesting story behind it, that it was actually this sort of abandoned. It was part of a regeneration scheme, and they built a big shopping center and a car park right in the middle of town. And then it kind of all went bust and ended up just sitting kind of derelict for many years. You can see a lot of the filming they did in local pubs and betting shops and little post offices and grocery stores. All the people are local people that just happened to be around on the day that they were shooting, and they just said, hey, would you mind kind of getting in the back and being in the picture, sort of thing. So the film has a time capsule of Newcastle at the time. I think it's quite interesting because you can see it's a very kind of grimy kind of place. You know, no offense to any listeners out there from Newcastle, because obviously this was a long time ago. But you could see all the terraced housing on the hills and the
those brick sort of tenements or whatever. Yeah, just kind of very anonymous, very, you know, claustrophobic feeling, even. Yeah.
Yeah, all the kind of social. Oh, sorry, Richard, go ahead.
I was going to say the one shot, I think it's when he's outside his brother's house with the street of terraced housing.
Yeah,
with
yeah.
the giant power plant in the background.
Oh,
it's
yeah.
It's one of the most desolate shots I've ever seen in the middle of a city.
Yeah, at first I thought this was like, is this Pink Floyd Animals? Like the cover area? You know? But it's pretty much that same kind of living in the industrial wasteland. It's just, you know, it's affordable housing. It's where you're stuck. And, you know, there's no consideration for, you know, air and water quality, environmental, you know, cleanliness, any of that kind of stuff. And even the very beginning of the film is kind of, once we've got the establishing shots of Jack Carter kind of in his London turf very briefly, it's this long train ride. And that's kind of the opening credit sequence as he's heading up north. And it goes on for several minutes. So you get the sense that, yeah, this is a long ride. And if you look at the map, you know, Newcastle is almost all the way up by Scotland there. So it's fairly well north in the north of England there. There's no sense of glamour or prospects or possibilities. These people are pretty much stuck. And even to get out of that and into London is an accomplishment in itself. So you're right. He's going backwards, but even though he's a ruthless killer and will, you know, take you out once he gets the orders to do so and a suitable payment, there is this sense of honor and duty, and that's kind of the complicated motives that drive this Carter character. Mm-hmm. He has an allegiance to his brother. You also find out as he sort of re-enters his home turf, there's a sense of responsibility to his brother's widow and their daughter. Even though it seems like their marriage has fallen apart and they've gone their separate ways, you know, family ties still seem to mean something to this man. And there's a little ambiguity as to even the parentage of this daughter. Dory is her name. One of his sidekicks, you know, kind of blurts out there. He wasn't even sure who was the father. So you know, obviously he's lived a very compromised and complicated life, and perhaps that's the kind of thing that got him into this, you know, dead-end situation, even though materially, perhaps, and reputationally, he's prospering a bit. He's known as one of the best in his field of trade, so to speak. And yet, he's willing to put all that on the line for the sake of vengeance and his own sense of justice. And so I guess I kind of want to ask a little bit, well, what do you guys think about his, you know, kind of his characteristics? Is Carter an admirable character? Is he somebody that we are supposed to identify with, or are we supposed to see him as just sort of a tragic victim of a fucked up set of circumstances?
I think there's kind of a yes and no on that. yeah. I'd say on the sort of most mundane level, you can say he kind of becomes admirable not just by being the protagonist, but by everyone else being worse. He kind of gets a little bit elevated by the people he's against being far worse people than him in many regards.
Right, right.
Go ahead.
I was going to say there's one of the things I really love about films in the 70s is that there's a very strong sort of existentialist trend in them, that especially in genre films, where there's a lot of protagonists who sort of end up defining everything by one goal. You know, they sort of become, they sort of self-define themselves in terms of the thing that they are doing. And I think in that sense, Carter kind of almost redeems himself.
So there is a redemptive aspect here. I mean, he is settling scores for people who pretty much deserve the miserable, wretched exit from this life that they get. Even Kinnear,
yeah.
You know, he's hauled away by the police. He's not killed at the end. And you kind of get the sense that he's got the money and the attorneys that'll probably either get him off entirely or at least a slap on the wrist type of sentence. But Carter has gone in and kind of thrown this little gangster underworld into chaos, you know, and so that is his revenge. And yet, you know, he himself, I mean, we've already kind of blurted that out there, he does not escape unscathed. As soon as he's kind of in his moment of exultant triumph, he takes it right between the eyes, as the reviewer politely informed us. and so there is no Get Carter 2. There's no sequel to this particular story. And I actually like that. I like the fact that existentialist element is kind of played up, and that nobody really wins here. Nobody emerges as triumphant. It's a nasty business, and it's being portrayed in strictly unglamorous terms.
I also think if he didn't need to push this so far that his own life was in danger and eventually lost, he'd lose any sense of likability.
Do you think in a sense that he almost knows that he's going to come to a sticky end, really? Or do you think that he just assumes he's going to walk away from it?
I think he knows he can't go back to London because his bosses know about Britt Eklund.
Yeah. Everything's been blown up. I mean, you know, and let's get into the Britt Eklund. She's given pretty prominent billing. Her screen time is fairly limited. There's a piece at the beginning where she's kind of, you know, introduced in this initial situation, and then there's a pretty memorable sequence within, I don't know, first 30, 35, 40 minutes or so of the film. And I think she kind of disappears pretty much after that. And so her billing may not quite live up to what she actually does in the film, but, you know, she was a little sex pot. She was an attraction of a sort, and she went on to become one of those infamous hotties of the 70s. I think she and Rod Stewart hooked up for several years, and Tonight's the Night and all that kind of thing. But, yeah, I don't know. What about her piece in it? Anybody want to comment on Britt Eklund's contributions to this particular production?
They seemed pretty disposable.
Apparently, I mean, there was more, but they cut a lot of it out. Unfortunately, they kept the bit where she, sort of exposes her skin and stuff. But but I think there were some other bits apparently that they cut during the editing.
Well, and that's kind of a shame because I think it is an interesting dynamic. Go ahead, Richard.
I was going to say I think in Germany they even cut that scene out.
Well, it was pretty steamy stuff, you know.
Yeah.
And speaking of Germany, those initial scenes where you've got Jack and the other gangsters sitting around looking at what look like slides from pornographic films or maybe, you know, clips from magazines. It actually reminded me of some of those early Fassbinder films where he kind of used those same types of, stills of smutty activity. This must have been a bit of a breakthrough for what you'd consider artistic mainstream type of cinema. And some of those situations are actually fairly graphic and explicit. I mean not quite as explicit as Fassbinder, where he puts everything front and center. But yeah, there was some pretty nasty business going on there. So again, it's just kind of another example of the emergence of a more frank and candid depiction of how adults actually behave on screen. At least some adults.
I think it's interesting too, Carter's whole attitude there. He likes to throw the money around, doesn't he? Like, if you can imagine being in Newcastle at the time, a lot of poverty and people kind of struggling to get by, and you have this guy who just every relationship, he just kind of if somebody gets a little bit upset or somebody gets punched in the face or whatever, he just brings out this wad of bills and sort of peels off a few and hands them over in this really callous way. But you can imagine how that would come across to people who are still stuck in that environment, that this kind of fancy man from from London is coming up and just throwing the cash around.
Yeah, it's what he's got to give. I mean, he's not a shoulder to cry on. He's not the most empathetic or emotionally supportive individual you're ever going to meet, but he does have money, and he knows that there's not a lot of money going around, and I don't know, it's kind of a cynical, calculated bargain, isn't it? That with Dory, you know, he wants to kind of help her get, you know, he invites her in his original scheme, this niece slash potential possible daughter, basically his surviving relative, you know, his one and only family member who seems to be in his life. He invites her along on this voyage to South America that he has planned with Anna, a Britt Eklund character, that he's going to, you know, go up and take care of business in Newcastle, head back down to London, hop a boat to South America, and start a whole new life. I mean, he's apparently got this all figured out. But Dory has her own ideas. I mean, she's still attached to her community. She's got a friend she's going to live with. So once he recognizes that she's not really on board with that plan, he slips her a couple bills, and she lights right up. She's pretty happy about that, yeah. You know.
I mean, Uncle Jack hasn't been around. He's been off in London for years. You don't really know the extent of the relationship they've had. So for her, he's just another bloke who's, given her a bit of cash so she can go and buy a nice new handbag or something. You know, that's kind of the extent of the relationship for her.
Yeah. However, she's got a much more complicated life going on than he suspects or she's willing to allude to. And that's discovered in probably the most, I don't know, to me at least, the most emotionally poignant moment of the film after he's, you know, made another conquest. There's a few moments. And before I get into that, let me just kind of take a moment to reflect on this image of Carter, the macho stud, you know, the cold-hearted killer, you know, the knock 'em dead lover boy. he is kind of this fantasy character, kind of a darker, grimier James Bond, if you will. You know, what do you guys think about that comparison? If you want to specifically play off the James Bond idea, where he's doing it in a much more glamorous and, you know, licensed to kill fashion, here's Get Carter taking all of those same dynamics, but ratcheting them down into kind of gutter snipe territory.
I did find there was a couple times when he did seem to display a little bit more heart. I don't know if you noticed in the scene near the beginning when he goes to his brother's flat and his body was there in the coffin, obviously waiting for the funeral. But there was just that very brief shot, just for a second, where he put his hand on his brother's hands and just kind of held them there. And just there's little kind of touches like that where you see that there is a little bit more feeling in Carter than you might immediately interpret from some of his actions and things. There are just those little kind of subtle touches that suggest that he has a lot more feeling in there than you might have realized.
I haven't read the book, but I have read that one of the things they removed was a bit of the backstory about him and his brother. And that they were quite close. And that shotgun that he has in the movie was his brother's, and it sort of represents they used to go hunting together.
Okay, so it was a hunting rifle, not an assassination weapon, you know?
Yeah, so I think his brother is his one tie to, say, normal world.
Yeah. Of just living life on its own terms without being this, you know, compromised felon who's always kind of stay one step ahead of the law, as well as, you know, gangland rivals and other assassins who might be setting to take him out on the orders of some other, you know, criminal boss from a rival mafia or whatever. So, yeah, I mean, this story is very complicated. So we were going to go back to, what was the point I was going to get back to here?
Oh, his discovery of the film.
Oh, yeah, his discovery of the film. Right. So that Dory was actually, well, cast in a part is a much more nuanced way of putting it than actually. She was basically raped on film and persuaded under who knows what kind of pretense to be part of this pretty nasty little production of what was at that point certainly a very illicit pornographic industry. You know, there was no legal trade in this type of thing. It was all very much a black market enterprise. And that's kind of an interesting perspective as well in this day and age where all that stuff is one click away, literally. It kind of reminds me of my own first experiences watching those types of films when I found my dad's little stash of little 8mm back in the 70s there. But let's forego the personal disclosure. That's probably enough right there.
That's for another podcast.
Yeah. Another time. As we get deeper into the 70s, I'm sure more of those stories may come out. But yeah, you know, so Dory was actually victimized, and as an underage woman, girl, really, that is what, you know, kind of turned Carter's engines to full fire. I mean, he was there to take care of some business because his brother died under very suspicious circumstances. But now, you know, this is just kind of completely blown over the top because not only was his brother killed, but Dory, his last hope for a better life in future, you know, he tells her, be good, don't trust boys. You know, he's got a very sincere hope that she might be able to somehow slip through the traps that life in Newcastle laid for him, laid for his brother. He's hoping that this next generation might have an easier go of it. And here he finds that she's been corrupted, you know, right from the get-go, practically. So, you know, that's basically what unleashes this last flurry of revenge and paybacks. And that basically takes us through the last half hour of the film where he's on a rampage and it's pretty awful, you know, to think about these things actually happening to real people. However it's portrayed fictionally or otherwise, it's very unsavory business. So, yeah, so what are your thoughts about that whole sequence there?
Sorry, I just wanted to jump in and just make an interesting little factoid there, or a funky fact, as my son would say. But apparently, Michael Klinger, the producer of the film, they said in the commentary track on the Blu-ray, I don't know if you guys had access to that. I think you were watching it on the Criterion Channel.
Yeah, we got the trailer and we got the film. That's about it.
Okay. Well, the commentary track is really good, but there was one interesting bit I just thought I'd mention while you were talking about the pornography, because apparently the producer, Michael Klinger, got his start in the 60s he started up porn clubs, and that was how he kind of made his fortune, if you will, in Soho in London. He started up these little private clubs where men could go and screen this type of material. So he has that sort of connection to that kind of world, if you will, which kind of, I just thought that was an interesting little bit to bring out.
Yeah. I mean, it is very interesting. It's kind of just one of these numerous underground scenes, if you will, from this era, where people have been kind of repressed and sequestered from this type of material, and so it finds a way of leaking out through illegal markets, and in the process exploiting people along the way. And it is interesting, I mean, because this is the one part of the film where you actually see Carter shed a tear. Like, that's a sincere moment of heartbreak and remorse and sorrow that this, you know, cold-blooded assassin is experiencing. To me, that really was quite powerful, just to sort of... And I was very caught up in that moment. Like, I felt like, yeah, that's not just manipulation. That felt very genuine.
Well, yeah, it's like you say, that was kind of like his last sort of beacon of kind of hope for kind of humanity, was his niece / daughter. So, yeah, to have that moment where he suddenly realizes that even that has been kind of destroyed is quite a powerful moment. And his performance is so amazing as well, because he's a real master, Michael Caine, is he, just using his face. He doesn't even have to say anything, does he? And he can really convey a lot in a scene.
Right.
I mean, he's such a great actor. He's one of those, I kind of liken him to someone like Denzel Washington, is that even when he's in a film that isn't really that great, he makes it worth watching, doesn't he? Because he's just got that charisma and that sort of presence and that ability to bring something out of scenes, even when maybe the material overall isn't that interesting.
Yeah, I mean, this material to me is pretty interesting, but I do think he elevates it beyond the sort of TV action sequence that our aforementioned critic wants to kind of dismiss this as. And I do find it pretty fascinating that Michael Caine actually actively pursued this role.
Yeah, he was apparently an unofficial producer in the film, too.
So where was he at? Now, he had done Alfie and he had done a few other films, but what was the impact on Michael Caine's career with this film? He seems to have sort of catapulted to future successes. Like this is an enhancer for him. This was not a distraction or a side project. This is a pretty major step in his kind of ascendancy, if you will.
Yeah, it was a very popular film. Like, I think he was coming out of the Italian Job on this one.
Oh, was the Italian Job before that?
I think so.
Think so, yeah.
Yeah, I think it's 69.
Oh,
yes, okay. It is.
Well, I got my years mixed up. I thought Italian Job was 72 or 73. So, well, there you go. So, I stand corrected.
Apparently, the MGM wanted Telly Savalas.
for this film?
They wanted him for the Brumby role. He was signed to this at like really early on, but before MGM came on, and then MGM came on, they wanted some stars in this, so they wanted Telly Savalas. They were suggesting him for Brumby, which is like one of the weirdest casting when you look at who actually played the role.
Yeah, well, does Telly Savalas have any connection to the UK?
No.
No, I didn't think so. So it's like that would have been a real big distraction. I mean, everybody here feels very pulled out of real life. You know, again, I mean, I can't speak as I knew Newcastle of that, but they certainly convey a sense of genuineness, authenticity, whatever, for being part of that environment. Brumby, the restaurateur, or at least the aspiring, entrepreneur of that scene. He's kind of this petty bourgeois, nouveau riche kind of guy who's found some easy money and he wants to kind of elevate himself to another level. And he's very afraid of the threats against him and of losing his life if he crosses the wrong paths, but he still wants to find a way to, get his own little petty revenge on the people who he sees has done him wrong. So to me, the casting of those supporting players is really quite brilliant, especially on the second watch through that I just completed this afternoon. I will say this, I mean, let me just say, for first-time viewers, there's a lot to keep track of. In fact, I'll just go back and recommend that you read the plot summation on Wikipedia. It is very complicated. It's like six or seven paragraphs long of all the characters, all the double crosses, all of the, interconnections that kind of bind this plot together. The first time through, if you're not steeped in this type of film, you may find your head spinning a little bit of keeping track of what's going on or who betrayed who or how these different characters connect. Give it another shot if you find yourself a little bit confused, because that was kind of my experience. And I think my first time through, I thought, well, this is interesting. Again, it may not match your mood of the moment, but stick with it. And I think the second time around to me really was somewhat revelatory. And I'm really glad that I took that full excursion into it, just to, now that I know kind of how it all wound up and what happened and the wherefores and whys, I really could appreciate the art and craft of it all the more.
Did you notice what he was, what Kane was reading on the train on the way up?
Yeah, Farewell, My Lovely, to Raymond Chandler.
Yeah, yeah. I think Raymond Chandler is a good comparison in that case. The complexity of the plot and the number of characters.
Yeah, that's a good bit of overshadowing, because I don't know if you picked it up, because I didn't pick it up on the first viewing either, but actually the guy at the end who kills him is actually sitting there in the train with him, in the carriage, almost like, you know, he was following him, you know, so it's quite interesting.
Yeah, it's kind of one of those things about, you know, about destiny, fate, you know, the crossing of paths, even the way that... I can't remember the woman's name right at the moment, but kind of the little hottie who he meets at Kinnear's poker party just shows up at the right moment to bail him out when everything seems to be crashing down. Sometimes life goes like that, where just bizarre, inexplicable coincidences happen that kind of give you that lucky break.
Well, and, was it a coincidence, though, or was that lady there because she mentioned that she'd met some of his bosses when they'd come up to Newcastle? So there is almost like, was she there? Did they give her a call and ask her to kind of play guardian angel for him? Or were they, did they ask her to keep an eye on him to see what he was getting up to? Or was the whole thing a setup or something? You know, you just don't know. It's left a little bit ambiguous.
Yeah, right. He's being watched. I mean, he's not operating in a void. The eyes are on him, and people are wondering what he's up to. And, of course, the woman who sees herself as maybe his protector or his guardian angel, she ends up paying a pretty harsh price for her involvement as well. I mean, there's just all kinds of nasty business going down here, you know.
For everyone who dies in this film, her death is almost the most sadly comical.
Oh, it's awful. Yeah. I mean, you know, he's just trying to shut her down and basically keep her contained so that she doesn't go blabbing to anybody who shouldn't hear what he's up to or spoil his schemes, and yet boom, you know, there she goes into the drink. It's just misery all the way around.
Would it be all right, David, for me to talk a little bit about some of the casting? Because you mentioned about some of the really great cast. A lot of the people who were cast in the film were quite interesting. For American audiences, some of them might not be so familiar. But I just
there's not a lot of household names. I mean, there's Britt Eklund, there's Michael Caine, and then there's a bunch of who is that person. So go ahead.
You mentioned about Brombery, I'm losing my ability to speak here for a second. But Brian Mosley, the gent who played him, actually went on to be quite a popular sort of personality on British television in Coronation Street. For years, he was sort of a central figure in that. So I thought he was worth mentioning. But some of the more interesting people that pop up are people like Alan Armstrong, who went on. He's been a fixture in British film and television for years. He's in one of my all-time favorite sort of television series called Our Friends in the North. But he's been in a lot of films over the years. George Sewell is he's one of the two guys who show up at the house to kind of the muscle men who are there to kind of try and escort Carter back onto a train and get him back to London. But he was also quite a prominent British character actor, quite recognizable to Gerry Anderson fans because he was a main character in the UFO TV series. But I think two of the most interesting people to mention are John Osborne, who played Cyril Kinnear, who's kind of one of the main baddies. He was actually quite a prominent playwright in the 50s and 60s, and he wrote Look Back in Anger. And he came up as an actor with Michael Caine when they were both starting out in the very sort of early part of their career. And then he went into writing and became quite a prominent British playwright. during the 50s and 60s when he was kind of known as the angry young man. And so I think it's quite notable that this is a very rare film role for him, that he only, I think, probably did it because Michael Caine, you know, they were friends and he probably had a connection there and got involved. But he's a very menacing figure, especially in that scene with the card game at the beginning. He has
I really enjoyed that performance. It was very laconic, very sinister, kind of, you know, again, he shows himself to be a mastermind of the criminal underworld. Like, he can get people to do things that are really against their own interests, but in the, you know, to his own advantage and the pursuit of his own power and control. You know, for a guy who maybe didn't fancy himself as a professional actor, I think he really nailed it.
Yeah, he's so menacing and just really kind of just even his voice. Michael Caine mentions on the commentary track that voice isn't his real voice, that he was putting that on, but it was just this really kind of like high pitched kind of creepy voice. But he just, it was so subtle enough that he just really gives off this very menacing vibe. And I think it's probably a shame he didn't do more film work, actually. I also wanted to mention, too, Ian Hendry, who was Carter's boyhood friend, the one who was the chauffeur, who was working for Cyril. He was actually quite a prominent film star in Britain and was quite a big star for a number of years. But at the time, apparently, that they made this film, he was his career was a bit on the decline. And he was had quite a severe alcohol problem.
So he's a Criterion connection here.
Oh yeah, he's in a lot of stuff. He's quite
Yeah,
absolutely. And he's quite a he was quite a prominent star at one time. Although I think nowadays people are probably not as familiar with him. But he apparently absolutely resented Michael Caine, who was obviously at the time, as you said, on the rise as a big film star and really quite successful. And while Ian Hendry was on the kind of on the decline. So apparently the director, which we should talk about a little bit as well, but he kind of used that to play the two off each other. And it does really create some really great scenes with the two of them, because apparently there was quite a bit of animosity, not from Michael Caine's part, but from Ian Hendry's part. So,
well, it you know doesn't why, help though. At all that he ends up getting bashed in the skull with the butt end of a rifle.
Yeah, Hendry.
Spoiler alert.
Hendry was actually originally cast as Carter.
Oh, yeah.
That's part of the reason. Hendry was cast as Carter before Michael Caine expressed an interest, and then Hendry was moved.
Oh, yeah, that would be upsetting.
Yeah, that's part of the resentment.
Well, that fuels things up for sure, but I don't think this movie would have worked quite as well. I mean, Michael Caine just has that je ne sais quoi.
One of the things I read is that... Hodges tried to do a rehearsal of the first scene that Hendry and Caine do together, like in an evening in a hotel room. And Hendry was so belligerent about it that he had to just call it off. That Hendry was clearly just really fuming at Caine and wasn't cooperating.
Well, you know, I don't necessarily buy into the alpha beta thing, but you know, Michael Caine totally owns Ian Hendry in their racetrack scene, and there's no way that you could have reversed those roles. I mean, Caine's got the height and the presence and the penetrating gaze, and you know, just he's just the dominant figure. So, I think the director and casting coordinator got it right here. So do we want to talk about Mike Hodges a little bit? He went on to do some other interesting stuff, although he's not necessarily a known auteur, and I don't think he's got any other films in the Criterion Collection, or maybe isn't even likely to. Mm-hmm. But what are some thoughts about Mike Hodges?
Well, I could certainly give you a little bit of background about him, because I think he's quite an interesting director, actually. I think post-Get Carter, he maybe hasn't... made a lot of really sort of important films, but certainly he made
some interesting ones.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, most significantly, he directed Flash Gordon.
Ah, yeah, yeah.
which
you
know,
he doesn't
right
seem
there,
to like.
Yeah, oddly enough, but you know, Get Carter and Flash Gordon. I think those two films right there pretty much cements your place in cinema history. I would think that's a fair comment. But Flash Gordon obviously is quite a cult film, even if it's a you know a little bit campy and stuff. But he also directed the Second Omen film. He directed a film called The Terminal Man with George Siegel, I believe it is.
And that is part of the sci-fi 70s collection that the Criterion Channel has, although I've seen some pretty unflattering reviews from some of our social yeah. media friends.
I don't think it's
gotten
a good
that one,
one
to myself. Yeah.
But you know terrible. What? Mike Hodges, his background was actually in television, like I think that reviewer at the beginning mm-hmm. that you quoted did. But his work in television, although the reviewer is quite dismissive, I think is quite significant. He was a regular contributor to The World in Action, which was kind of the prime sort of current affairs news program on ITV during the kind of 60s, 70s, and maybe into the early 80s. It's kind of like, I guess, an equivalent of what you would, like your, is it 2020, the one that you have on Sunday, you know, with Mike Wallace?
60 Minutes, 2020.
60 Minutes, 2020, yeah, those kind of programs. Yeah, right. But it was quite significant because they had all sorts of directors who kind of traveled the world and made little documentaries about current affairs programs. So that's quite significant. I would recommend to listeners to search out the network video here in the UK, which is a specialist label that puts out a lot of archival television. They've done a few volumes of World in Action documentaries, and they're definitely worth searching out if you can still get hold of them. I don't know for certain because the liner notes, I had a look, and they don't necessarily mention who the directors are in all the films. But obviously, Mike Hodges, is possible he might have contributed to some of the stuff that's on those. But he also came up prominently working in something called Armchair Theater, which was a program where they had live you know, live plays and things that they broadcast on television. He also worked on a show called Tempo, which was a quite important arts program that used to be on. So he kind of comes from a documentary background. And I think you can really get that sense along with the cinematographer who we should probably talk about as well, because he's quite an interesting chap. But Mike Hodges came from this documentary background. I think you really get that sense from Get Carter of that kind of style, just from the use of the locations and the camera angles and the kind of choice of ways that he chose to frame things. So he's quite an interesting director. He made a couple other kind of notable films. He made a film about the Northern Ireland situation called A Prayer for the Dying, which I think stars Mickey yeah. Rourke, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, and Bob Hoskins. That's a really good film.
Yeah, it's one of those films that at the time didn't really make much of an impact, but I think subsequently people now have gone back and said, you know, actually that was quite a really good film. And he also remade a Fellini film in English called The Ship Sails On. He did a kind of remake of that for sort of, I assume it was American company, but I've not seen that, but I just thought that was worth noting as well. So he's quite an interesting director. He's not one of those people, like you say, who's quite sort of prominent as an auteur or whatever. People don't really think of him that way, but I think he's had quite a varied and interesting career, and he's worth sort of just mentioning that.
He had a very late career resurgence too with the film Croupier with Clive Owen.
Oh yeah, yeah, that's right.
Yeah, that got a lot of attention, partly because he had to fight to get it released, but that was very well received. And then he did a follow-up, I'll Sleep When I'm Dead, with Clive Owen again. That's not quite as good, but they're both, like, those are his last two films, and they're both pretty good.
And he's still alive. So he's up there in years. I don't know if he's actively working anymore. But, well, it sounds like an interesting career.
I'll just mention, too, for anyone who's in the UK, Mike Hodge is apparently the NFT here, you know, like the British Film Institute. They have a cinema down in South Bank here in London that they are actually having a retrospective on Mike Hodges in May of 2020, so in just a few months' time. So it's just worth mentioning that I might go down and check that out if he does a talk or anything during the...
That's a great recommendation, and certainly, yeah, keep us posted if you actually attend any of those events, but that's pretty cool that he's getting some recognition at this point, so good on him. David, you kind of alluded to the cinematographer, a gentleman by the name of Wolfgang Schizitsky. Do you want to go ahead and fill us in a little bit about that particular character?
Yeah, absolutely. In researching the film, and David, I would just say thank you for taking the hit on saying his surname.
Yeah.
Because I was a little bit nervous about trying to say that. But he is quite an interesting character. Actually, I read a little bit about him just in preparation for the podcast. And apparently he was someone, he originally came from Vienna. But he left in the 30s, obviously, because he was Jewish, and he was also a socialist. And obviously those two things at the time in that area of the world were not going to make him
trouble.
Very... Yeah, exactly. So he kind of saw the writing on the wall and left. And he kind of went via Amsterdam, but then he ended up in London. And apparently his parents, too, owned a radical bookshop in Vienna before the war. So there was that connection to being sort of politically radical person. But he ended up in London and he established himself as quite a well-known photographer. And he did quite a famous set of photographs in the Charing Cross Road when they were building all that. And he took a lot of pictures of working people and the environment at the time. And he also kind of set up a studio and became quite prominent nature photographer, like animal photographer. And he actually wrote a lot of photography books telling people how to become better photographers and things. And apparently they were quite successful. So he was quite a prominent photographer already, and then in kind of the 60s he got more involved in documentary filmmaking again. I say again meaning because Mike Hodges came from that same background of just learning their craft in that kind of catching the moment, responding to things as they happened, finding nice way to get good photographs and good pictures in very different types of circumstances. And I think a lot of that really shows in the film. But he's quite an interesting character, and he did quite a few films throughout the 70s. And then he kind of reverted as he got older into doing more photography and things again, and had some quite prominent exhibitions and things throughout the years. So I just thought it was worth mentioning him too, because as I read about him, he was actually just a really fascinating character with quite a rich kind of experiences and background. So, and you can kind of see that in the film. Certainly the Blu-ray that I picked up so I could watch the film here, it's beautiful. The photography is really beautiful, and you really get the grit and the grime of Newcastle at the time. And I think even aside from the film itself, you could take the film almost as like a snapshot of Newcastle at the time. You know, you could see all the environment and what the city was like.
He's also... He's the father of Peter Schizitsky, who is David Cronenberg's cinematographer.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I do remember them saying that his son was a cinematographer, but I didn't realize he worked with Cronenberg, so that's quite interesting.
Yeah,
I just clicked the link.
Yeah, he's got a ton of credits. Empire Strikes
Rocky
Back.
Horror, Empire Strikes Back, Mars Attacks. I mean, that's amazing.
Listomania. So, yeah.
Well... Yeah, we're kind of deep into the trivia here, but that's really fascinating, and the Cronenberg connection as well. He's worked with John Borman, Ken Russell, Tim Burton, and others. So, yeah, this is quite fascinating. Well, you know, kind of going back to your mention of the UK Blu-ray, I really think this would be a very worthy Criterion Collection physical media release.
Oh, absolutely.
If they can score, this is an MGM film. Of course, Criterion has done their share of business with Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer. Let's maybe kind of hone back in on the legacy of this film. We've already alluded to, you know, films like The Long Good Friday and the other kind of British gangster films, Bob Hoskins and all of that. What do you think is the lasting significance? Even though this may be just a temporary blip on the Criterion Collection radar because of its, you know, apparently brief appearance on the channel, although there's no termination date. I mean, it's been up for a month or two. I don't know if it's going to be leaving at the end of February. Maybe it'll be on longer. I certainly hope listeners give it a chance and check it out. But yeah, what is the bigger term impact of Get Carter? I know there was a Sylvester Stallone starring sequel. I haven't seen it yet. Remake. Has anybody?
Yeah,
a remake. Sequel or remake. You're right.
Yeah, I've seen it. It is terrible. It's got Mickey Rourke in it. It's got Mickey Rourke in it, but it's awful.
Okay.
There's also there's a blaxploitation remake that was made the following year called Hitman.
And is that worth checking out?
It's okay. It's a pretty good blaxploitation film. It's got like Bernie Casey and in the Michael Caine role. It's set in Las Vegas instead.
Okay.
Which is kind of funny because that's what the Stallone remake is. Too. It's also set in
well, and Vegas. And doesn't Jack Carter say he's staying at the Las Vegas, like the name of the, I don't know, the hotel or the boarding house or whatever? He mentions Las Vegas in one of his little scenes fairly early on, so that's an interesting little through line there.
I think Michael Caine's in it as well, isn't he, Richard? I haven't seen it since it came out, but
yeah, he has a small role in it. You're right. Yeah.
Okay. Well, I'll stick with the original there, but yeah, let's get back to, what is your kind of overall assessment of this film? Is this one that belongs as part of the Criterion canon? Is this ephemera? What do you think?
I think it's a film that transformed its genre in England, right?
Yeah.
I don't think there are English gangster films that are like this before it. There are ones, but they're not so. The sort of working class realism and the tough guy-ness of it is sort of where the genre went after this. So, I mean, in a sense, it's kind of the Night of the Living Dead of British gangster films.
Yeah, I like that. That's a good analogy. David, what is your kind of bottom line on this film?
Well, yeah, no, I mean, Richard summed it up very well. I think there's kind of a before and after. Get Carter was kind of quite a seminal sort of British film of the period, I think. It did kind of change the landscape for these types of crime films and just the image of the sort of British kind of crime underworld, organized crime and all that. Definitely you can see its influence on like modern films like, you know, Lock, Stock and Two Smoking Barrels and all those kind
of... Guy Ritchie stuff, right?
Yeah, and I can't remember the name of the one that Daniel Craig was in. I can't remember the name of that. But you can see a lot. I mean, and now, unfortunately, I think the kind of British gangster film has become a little bit of a cliche, and there's not very many good ones that kind of come out anymore because they all have a very similar kind of vibe to them and stuff. But I think this is
the problem of genre films, is they kind of have a shelf life and then they become parodies of themselves, and you got to sort of find a new avenue, right?
You can almost say this film influences Guy Ritchie and then Guy Ritchie destroys the British gangster
economy. Yeah. Were you thinking of like Layer Cake or something like that?
Layer Cake. That was the one I was trying to think of. Layer Cake. Yep. Yeah, sorry. Okay. Yeah, I mean, I wasn't like a huge fan of those films myself, but that's kind of why I couldn't think of the name of it. But I think
they kind of serve their purpose. They kind of draw, young men in, and this seems to me very much a guy's film. You know, this is the boys' night out type of a movie, whether that's out in the theater or having them over to your house or whatever. But yeah, that seems like. And so, and for those who have grown up on Guy Ritchie films or even Daniel Craig's James Bond movies, this might be a nice, you know, kind of throwback to get to back to the roots when it was all raw, gritty, and real.
I think from Michael Caine's point of view, too, this is quite a seminal film. I think when people always talk about Michael Caine, there's that sort of small batch of films that he's most sort of famous for, and that would be kind of Zulu and The Italian Job and Elfie. Mm-hmm. And then there's this one. And these are kind of the kind of films that everyone, you know, remembers Michael Caine for the most, like as the...
And then the late career Batman stuff, of course, yeah, for the younger set.
But these are the films that kind of cemented his reputation and his stardom, you know. After this, like throughout the 70s, he did do a lot of maybe not so great films all the time. I mean, there's a few great ones there, like The Man Who Would Be King and a few others, but he did a lot of, so, you know, maybe not so great films. You know, I'm just talking in general. There's a few good ones in there. But I think these early films are the ones that kind of really cemented his reputation and, you know, made him the star that he is, the much beloved kind of icon of film, you know, so...
So, yeah, I think Michael Caine is definitely a star for the ages, and I think this kind of established that platform for him to do, like you say, the Alfred the Butler stuff and many other things that, you know, will cement his legacy and continue to draw new viewers in to find out what this guy was all about. So,
sorry, any Dave, final? Yeah, I just wanted to mention too, because we would be very remiss if we didn't mention Roy Budd in the soundtrack.
That's exactly what I was about to say.
Yeah, very good. Let's go through that. Yeah, and there will be definitely some samples. There have already been for listeners. I'll use that for the intro and outros, but talk about music.
Well, I could just mention from the British perspective, Roy Budd was quite a prominent sort of personality, both in the music scene in Britain in kind of the 60s. He was on television a lot, and he was quite a well-known figure at the time. And the music that he did for this film, a lot of it was just improvised while he watched the film. And actually, again, if you have the Blu-ray, there is a nice little, they call it a trailer on the film, but it's really just this almost like a music video that just shows him playing the theme tune along with the film sort of projecting in the background, which is quite a nice little little bit. I don't know what that was from, what it was used for, if it was used as a promotional thing or on television or something. I don't know, because it's obviously a bit early for music videos, 1971. But I think the music from this film has subsequently become quite a highly sampled thing and is quite widely used in television commercials and things like that, certainly here. And I think it's quite an iconic film score, quite famous. So I think it was just... Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, it's like Human League, do it on one album, and Stereo Lab, and it's very influential.
Yeah, so I thought we didn't want to pass without mentioning that, because it's quite a kind of a classic soundtrack, I think.
Yeah. When I was watching it last weekend, I just had it playing, and my wife said, "That sounds like a spy gangster movie." It's just hearing that opening theme. I said, "Yeah, you nailed that one." it seems pretty iconic, pretty epitomizing of the genre, and perfectly matches the mood. There, that little rolling bass line there, and kind of that funky riff that he gets going on there. It's a nice little intro, draws you into the film, and lets you jump on the ride from there.
Because he's sort of improvising it to the film, apparently Bud had a harpsichord, a Wurlitzer electric piano, and a grand piano in front of him, and he was playing all three
Wow.
somewhat simultaneously, and then added, "That wasn't very comfortable."
Wow. Oh, well, yeah, because the opening credits say music composed and performed by Roy Budd. And I thought, well, he's got to have a band going here, you know. But it's, so you're saying he was actually working all those keys.
He's working all the keyboards, and he's got percussion.
Yeah, you can see it in that little clip that I mentioned, that he's,
okay,
he's literally, yeah, cool. He's just on like a little swiveling chair, and he sort of opens on the piano, and then he swings around and he plays another sort of keyboard instrument. And yeah, you know, it's all quite, you know, off the cuff, and just terrific, really. I think I might get me a copy of that record.
Yeah, I'll be looking him up as a composer, somebody to add to my streaming music collection there, and yeah, that's just one more little enticement for hopefully a future domestic Blu-ray release here in North America. Mm. Well, fantastic! There's a lot of interesting aspects that have been brought to the forefront here, even things that I didn't know about coming into this discussion. I'm really glad that we took this little detour into a Criterion Channel exclusive to talk about Get Carter. Any final comments or thoughts on the film? It sounds like we've all got a pretty strong recommendation here.
I would definitely give it a recommendation. Like I said, I'd always been relatively dismissive of this film in the past, not because I didn't like it. I do like it. But I'd liken it a bit more to like something like we talked about a couple of weeks ago, like the Omega Man, that, yeah, you know, I didn't really sort of take it that seriously as a film, just a good piece of entertainment, a good revenge, mm-hmm, sort of gangster film. But I never really thought that much about it. But this week, like I said, it's kind of gone up quite a bit in my estimation now. And I think, you know, I think it's definitely worth checking out if you've never seen it.
Yeah, I think there's definitely some substance here, and it, like as we've already said, it lays the groundwork for some future excellent films, great performances, and just kind of a whole exploration of this slice of life. So, Richard, what are your kind of closing thoughts here?
You should watch this film.
Nicely, succinctly said. All right, listeners, well, thank you very much for joining us on this journey into the world of Get Carter. Bleak endings and all, I think it's one that rewards the watch and the rewatch. So I hope you all have a chance to check it out. Let us know if you've got comments, questions, feedback, or opinions in the Criterion Reflections, the group Facebook page, or wherever else you might see links pop up for this show on social media. We'd like to hear from you and encourage the conversation to keep on going. Our next episode will be yet one more Criterion Channel film popping up from 1971. This will be Brother John, starring Sidney Poitier. It's been announced as part of a February release package coming up, so we'll be back in early February talking about Brother John, which is a sounds like a kind of an interesting premise here, a man who sort of shows up when people are about to die. So I'm interested in Sidney Poitier, and I think it'll be an interesting discussion, whatever that film turns out to be. Haven't seen it yet myself, but that's next up in our queue, so we hope you tune in then and find a chance to check us out. Thank you very much, everybody, and we'll be getting back at you very soon.
Cheers. Bye. Falling